Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The U.S. coalition in Syria has shot down another Syrian drone 2 days after it downed a Syrian jet near Raqqa. The U.S. says it's only interested in fighting ISIS, but do these incidents indicate a shift back to the goal of regime change? Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko met with Donald Trump at the White House earlier today, praising his country's reforms and saying Ukraine is a story of success. Is Trump signaling that his administration will continue the Obama policy towards Russia? The special election in Georgia's 6th district is taking place today in what has been the most expensive House election in history. Democrats are hoping to pick up a seat, but does their campaign show that they are continuing to stubbornly refuse to move in a progressive direction? But first, we turn to the fighting in Syria. We are joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you for joining once again. Today, the U.S. coalition announced that an Iranian-made but Syrian-controlled drone aircraft was shot down by a U.S. F-15 fighter jet in southern Syria near Atamf, which is the fifth time that the U.S. has struck at forces allied with the Damascus government in the area in recent weeks. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, there is an extremely tense war of maneuver now going on in East Syria. I think where you really have to start to understand this, once you're aware of who is on, I would say, what are now four or five multifaceted sides, is that ISIS is no longer an offensive threat to anyone, except possibly the Syrian garrison that is defending and has defended under siege from ISIS for the last 3 or 4 years, the city of Deir ez-Zor in the east, where there's 100,000 civilians that have been protected and fed via airlift by the Syrian army from ISIS. That is the only place where ISIS still has any potential to cause any real damage to anyone. The biggest threat in Syria now is Al-Qaeda and the other 31 flavors of jihad, but they're penned up in Idlib province right now, and because of the Saudi-Qatari squabbling, they're actually fighting each other, jihadis that are backed by Saudi fighting jihadis that are backed by Qatar and vice versa. It's not about ISIS per se in East Syria anymore. It's a race for territory. And no one will talk about this, but this is what it's about. Everyone presents it as it's all about ISIS. It's not about ISIS. ISIS is actually more a pretext, especially for the U.S. to be there, than anything else at this point. It should come as a surprise to no one that the Syrian government wants to retake all of its country. Okay, there's no real subterfuge involved there. But the U.S. wants its proxies in East Syria to take as much land as they can and hold it against the Syrian government. It's not clear at this point whether their plan is, shall we say, the neocon plan B, the Brookings deconstructing Syria scenario that would be a partition of the East into a kind of Sunnistan or Salafistan, possibly with a Kurdish province in northeast Syria as well, Kurdish state. That is not clear. It could be simply that the U.S. wants to hold as much territory for leverage in future negotiations for whatever eventual peace settlement occurs in Syria. But right now, the U.S. wants to take as much territory. The problem is its main proxies in East Syria are the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they're called, which is 95% the Kurdish leftist YPG, which Turkey has big problems with. also where the Kurds are now moving south into Raqqa, the ISIS capital in Syria. They're now well into territory where that is not Kurdish ethnic majority territory anymore. It's Sunni majority territory, and the rest further south is. This means it's very complicated for the SDF, the YPG, to hold this territory. They can take it, but then you would have Kurds essentially governing over local Sunnis, which to a large extent have plenty of reason to resent them. Now, there are about 5% of the SDF that is a token Sunni tribes, many of them that actually used to be part of ISIS but then broke away, were turned on by it, and so on. But some of them have their own separate battalions within Syria of Democratic Forces. Some of them are more mixed, but they're really only kind of a token, a icing on the cake, if you will. So what's going on is in southeast Syria, the very corner down by Jordan, the right across the border from Jordan and very close to the Iraqi border. The U.S. has illegally established a military base, Al-Tanf. And the purpose of this base is to try once again the failed mission for the last 5 years of training, manufacturing up a moderate Sunni militant rebel force. Ostensibly, this is for ISIS, fighting ISIS, but I think everyone knows that's not true. ISIS isn't even in that area. It's been driven out of southeast Syria, has no presence there. This is for eventually occupying this eastern Syrian territory and perhaps again challenging the Syrian government. Now, this is called the New Syrian Army. There's about 150 U.S. troops and troops from several other countries, including two Gulf countries. We could assume it's probably Saudi and Jordan, and Norway and the United Kingdom. Norway has troops there. Now, of course, they are illegally on Syrian territory. None of them have been invited there. It is against international law for them to be there. They have unilaterally declared their own deconfliction zone. They claim it's an established one. The Russian foreign minister says, what zone are you talking about? We never negotiated this. You're just making this up and declaring it, which seems to be the case. But what it is a safe zone for their proxies in southeast Syria. The problem is they haven't been able to train up enough of this Sunni new Syrian army in East Syria to make any real difference. When the Syrian army is rolling across east and southeast Syria right now, rolling up ISIS very quickly, it's crumbling. They're taking large amounts of territory. When they got close to the proximity of this base, we saw a number of U.S. strikes on Syrian troops, on Iraqi militias, Shiite Iraqi militias, some of them led or at least advised by Iran. The same Shiite militias, Iraqi Shiite militias that the U.S. is allied with in Iraq, they are bombing in Syria. And this is because they want to secure the territory around this base and presumably much more further north of this. So they have been making airstrikes. This is where these drones have been shot down. And the situation is very tense. Rather than confront directly, the Syrian army has just made a very rapid maneuver and rolled across, greeting Iraqis at the Iraqi border and basically cut off this base and these new Syrian army proxies, not that there's very many of them, from the northern rest of East Syria. In response, what the U.S. tried to do was have the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds and sundry, in northeast Syria roll down south of Raqqa to prevent the Syrian army from relieving the besieged Deir ez-Zor, which is now, I would say, the most important city, the most important population area in all of East Syria at this point. The Syrian government wants to have had it. They've held it. They want to keep it. The U.S. would like to see it fall. There are reports. This is coming actually from Anne Barnard at the New York Times. She said just over a week ago, there are signs that to take Raqqa without an all-out fight, they will let more Islamic State escape to the south. and then follow the fight south to Deir ez-Zor. They are basically allowing, maybe even negotiating with ISIS to pull out of Raqqa without any type of serious fight, to move and try to finally take Deir ez-Zor, which of course the U.S. and Sundry would then just take it back from them again and claim that we're liberating it, but they wouldn't have to take it from the Syrian government. This is basically the game that is being played right now. It's a maneuver, a race for territory, and there are some loose established rules. Whoever takes territory, be it the Syrian government and its allies, or the U.S. proxies, holds it. There haven't been any direct confrontation other than, well, there have been the U.S. strikes on the Syrian government, but they haven't tried to take any territory away from either side. And that is the game. Those are the rules that are established so far. So that's this race for territory. That's what it's all heating up. ISIS is gone, and we're now into essentially the post-ISIS phase already. Everyone is preparing for where no one knows what type of settlement or conflict will occur between the U.S. proxies in East Syria and the Syrian government and its allies, Iran, Russia, Hezbollah, and so on.
We're speaking with Mark Sloboda. He's an international security and international affairs analyst and security analyst. And we're talking to Mark from Moscow about the growing confrontation between the United States forces and the Syrian government in Syria. The United States, of course, shot down, U.S. aircraft shot down a Syrian government jet that was apparently bombing ISIS positions south of Raqqa in eastern Syria. I think the pilot is presumed lost, missing, perhaps dead. It was over ISIS-controlled territory. Mark, let me just ask you, in response, Moscow said that its air defenses would track all coalition, that is, U.S. targets, west of the Euphrates River. The Euphrates kind of cuts the eastern part of Syria in the middle. It would now track all U.S. aircraft west of the Euphrates and suspend the deconfliction hotline. Of course, Moscow has accused the U.S. of not using the hotline between the two countries to prevent the Raqqa incident, meaning to prevent the shootdown that the U.S. unilaterally did of a Syrian aircraft. In terms of U.S.-Russian relations, is this a changing point in the war?
Not yet. We are approaching a conflict point, and incidences such as this have escalated things. But Russia has responded, I would say even perhaps too moderately to this. As far as Russia is concerned, they have won the strategic game in Syria, in East Syria especially. What they are doing is they are trying not to provoke a confrontation with the United States. They are waiting for them to recognize how poor and how little options they have to give up with some saving of face, you know, with a declaration, a joint declaration of ISIS being defeated, and go away. That's what Russia is hoping for at this point. So they're ignoring the occasional jabs that the U.S. is tossing their way. This particular incident with this shooting down of the Syrian bomber over Syrian airspace, the U.S. says it was protecting the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurds and Sundry, that they claim the Syrian government was attacking in one particular town, Jadin. And they claim, make a completely bogus claim of collective self-defense as making it legitimate and legal under international law, which the Just Security blog, a U.S. security blog, has ripped all to pieces. It's so many ways it's against international law that it's just a joke argument. The Syrian government says they were pursuing ISIS, and that the Syrian army had already taken this particular town and there were no Kurdish forces there. This actually does seem to be supported by the evidence. The Kurds, the SDF, never made a claim that they had taken this particular town, Jadin. And the pro-rebel UK-funded Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is really just one rebel propagandist sitting in London, even he, or the observatory, if you want to call it, has said that the U.S. version is not true, that the Syrian government was not targeting the Syrian Democratic Forces because they weren't there, and that it was indeed pursuing an ISIS convoy that was fleeing Raqqa towards Deir ez-Zor. So when even the U.S. pro-rebel propagandists are disputing their version of events, I think there's good reason to quest it. But regardless, of course, what they did is a unilateral action against the sovereign government and against international law.
Mark, we have about 3 minutes left. Time goes so fast. I want to quickly ask you that the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, again, mainly the Kurdish group, the YPG, the group that's advancing on Raqqa, said that, quote, the regime, this is the Syrian government, the regime's forces have mounted large-scale attacks using planes, artillery, and tanks since June 17th. If the regime continues attacking our positions in Raqqa province, we will be forced to retaliate and defend our forces. Now, the Syrian government had previously said that the YPG, the biggest force in the Syrian Democratic Forces, was waging a just struggle against Daesh, against ISIS. Does this mean that their position has changed? We have about 2 minutes left.
First of all, the Kurds are not a monolith. It's important to understand that the Syrian government and Russia have, throughout the civil war, supported, armed, provided close air support for the Kurds, including at times even the Syrian Democratic Forces. And it's not clear that this message that came out is actually true in any way. There certainly haven't been any reports of any large-scale offenses before this date from the Syrian government on SDF territory. And in fact, SDF and the U.S. have willingly turned over territory to the Syrian government in at least two locations in order to prevent Turkish and their proxy advances out of north central Syria. So I wouldn't consider this a final statement on the matter. I don't think that Russia regards the Kurds as a significant territorial threat to the territorial integrity of Syria. I think they see them as people that can be reasoned with. They haven't really directly fought the Syrian government. They fought Turkish proxies. They fought U.S. proxies funded by the CIA. They're funded by the Pentagon. And they fought ISIS, but they haven't really fought the Syrian government except for a few local squabbles that were quickly papered over. One other important thing, I think, is that the Trump government, the Trump admin, appears completely divided on this issue. There are a few neocons, Ezra Cohen Warwick, who is the senior director for intelligence on the National Security Council, and Derek Harvey, the National Security Council's top Middle East advisor, who are pushing this in East Syria for U.S. confrontation. They're trying to frame it as stopping Iran. It's not about Syrian government. It's not about Russia. It's about stopping Iran in East Syria. This is the way they're trying to present it to win Trump to their side. Meanwhile, Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, McMasters, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of Dunford, and others may be pushing back against this idea and want the U.S. to just focus on ISIS instead. That's at least according to anonymous sources reporting to Foreign Policy last week.
That's it. We're out of time. We are completely out of time. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international affairs and security analyst. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko met with Donald Trump at the White House earlier today, praising his country's reforms and saying Ukraine is a story of success. Is Donald Trump signaling that his administration will continue the policy of President Barack Obama towards Russia? We are joined in studio by Jim Jatras, a political analyst and former U.S. diplomat. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here.
Poroshenko told Trump during his visit, quote, "We are really fighting to bring freedom and democracy, and with a very strong support in the security and defense sector, support of our reform, support of my 45 million nation of the country, who is the biggest in the European continent. And I am absolutely confident that Ukraine is a story of success." Wow. Was the visit played down by the White House?
I think it was. I didn't see a whole lot of fanfare for it. I can't help being struck by the mention of 45 million people in Ukraine being a success. Remember a few years ago, we were talking about Ukraine as 50 million people and counting downward. That doesn't sound like too much of a success right now.
So while the meeting was taking place, the U.S. Treasury Department announced new sanctions against dozens of so-called separatist fighters in the eastern and southern part of Ukraine. Their leaders, their allies. What do you make of the new sanctions?
Well, frankly, Brian, it strikes me as what you asked, started the program with. Is this just a continuation of the policy we've seen in the past? And it seems so it is, that, as we know, Donald Trump ran on an America First policy. We haven't really seen that. We've seen a Saudi First policy. I guess we're going to see now a Ukrainian First policy. I don't see what dog the United States has in this fight. And Mr. Trump seemed to be quite clear about that during the campaign. Why is Crimea our problem, for example? Why isn't that the Europeans' problem? So I'm not sure why he's taking this tack, and it comes in the context of the Senate overwhelmingly passing a bill that would sanction Russia and Iran, but also European companies doing business with the Russians. And again, where is this coming from? It's not coming from any perceivable America First agenda that I can tell.
Right. So the United States sanctions against Russia now reveal themselves, really. Well, they always revealed themselves, but it's crystal clear now that they're sanctions against Europeans who dare to do business with Russia in the energy sector, something that would clearly be in the interests of the European countries, in the interests of Germany.
Sure. And, it's even going a step further. We've had sanctions since the outbreak of the Ukraine crisis in late 2013. And Barack Obama was quite specific about this, that we were holding the Europeans' feet to the fire. They did not want to do this, but we were, in effect, forcing them to, and for the sake of allied solidarity and all this other nonsense. Now we're going a step farther, which is to directly sanction European companies, not just to cut off, for example, various kinds of sort of a unified position on what kind of business we will all do with Russia, but the United States unilaterally hitting our European partners if they conduct certain business activities with the Russians. This is a step further.
Right. So here's the headline from Forbes magazine. Forbes magazine. Ukraine goes on anti-Russia pipeline offensive as Europe goes nuts. I mean, that's quite a dramatic headline. Help the audience understand what's going on with the pipeline.
Well, look, there are two pipelines involved here. One is, of course, the whole network that belongs to Naftogaz Ukraini, which is the Ukrainian state-owned network, which is historically the transit route to Europe, one of the main ones for Russian gas. The other one is the Nord Stream pipeline and now Nord Stream 2, which is at issue now. If that goes fully into effect, Ukraine becomes almost irrelevant as a transit company. It really would be more or less the end of Naftogaz. It's a declining stock in that respect. And I think what they want to do is save their strategic importance by having the U.S. try to kill Nord Stream 2. And of course, this has the Germans up in arms, which is rather ironic because remember, it was the Germans that played a very key role in killing the South Stream pipeline, which would have benefited Greece, Italy, the Balkans, and so forth, Austria, many of members of the European Union. But the Germans, putting their own interests first, did not go along with that, although they were very careful to let Nord Stream go forward.
So I'm going to help the audience, which may not have a giant familiarity with the issue of pipelines. I'm going to read a little bit from the Forbes magazine article and then help you dissect this, try to unpack this. With Washington's blessing, Ukraine is going on the offensive against a Baltic Sea pipeline it deems a death knell to the state-controlled Naftogaz. That's the Ukrainian company, state-owned. Naftogaz is one of the most important companies in the country and the gateway between Russian gas fields and the European market. This is the ultimate fight, only this time it pits Ukraine and the U.S. on one side with the Europeans and Russians, oddly enough, on the other side. I mean, irony of ironies, we had the Maidan crisis that began in 2013 when Germany, the leader of the EU, issued an ultimatum to Yanukovych. You accept the European Association Agreement, the economic deal that would allow Ukraine to enter into a semi sort of normal status with the EU, but on the basis of austerity imposed on Ukraine. Yanukovych said no to the ultimatum. The protests began in Maidan in October, November 2013. ultimately, in order to bring that wave of months-long protest, there was an agreement signed on February 21st between the Ukrainian government and the protesters, with Germany and Poland and France and Russia and the United States as observers to this signing of the treaty, of the deal. And that deal, the February 21st deal, would allow for the decentralization of power in Ukraine, early elections so that Yanukovych would have to stand once again. And yet the next day, the armed forces of the militias, the right wing, very, very right wing, I would say not Nazi-like militia, seize power, disperse the parliament. Yanukovych leaves the country. The United States and the EU say it's a great new day for Ukrainian democracy and freedom. So the U.S. and the EU prompted that crisis, but now EU, Germany in particular, may be its victim.
That's right. And look, maybe there's even more here going on than meets the eye. Maybe this is some kind of a crazy, like a fox agenda that Trump has. Having gone to Europe in May and read them the Riot Act over NATO burden sharing and all this sort of stuff and offending the Europeans, maybe what he's really trying to do here is to alienate the Europeans from American policy, have them get closer to Russia so we can say it's Miller time and get out of Europe. I don't think he's doing that, but you almost wonder if that's going to be the ultimate effect of it. And it ends up getting to where maybe he was talking about last year, but right now it seems to be going in the other direction. We're simply doubling down on a failed policy of treating Ukraine as something that belongs to us, as though, you know, you hear over and over again, the Ukrainian people have chosen European orientation. When do the people of any country ever unanimously choose anything? Do we ever unanimously choose things here in the United States between, you know, red states and blue states? No. You know, you have a very divided country in Ukraine, like most other countries are. There was no unanimous choice of a Western orientation at the expense of Ukraine's historic relationship with Russia.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the success story that Poroshenko, here in Washington today, meeting with Trump, declared Ukraine to be. Now, Ukraine was historically Russia's biggest ally. It was the second biggest republic in the Soviet Union. Crimea was always part of Russia until it was transferred as part of an administrative decision by Nikita Khrushchev and that transitional leadership between Stalin's death
in 1954.
In 1954. So in other words, they were transferring Crimea to Ukraine when Ukraine and Russia were one country, when they were part of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So it wasn't considered to be then a big deal. But when that coup d'etat happened, and when it became clear that there would be an anti-Russian government taking power in Kiev, and that it was likely that that government would then apply for NATO membership, something Yanukovych said that Ukraine would not do. And I think Yanukovych was playing Europe against Russia and Russia against Europe. In other words, somewhere in the middle, not a Russian ally per se. But Yanukovych didn't favor Ukraine coming into NATO. Now, once it was clear that through the coup d'etat of February 22nd, 2014, it became, I think, clear to the Russian leadership that Crimea, a Russian base, would suddenly become a NATO base on Russia's frontier. That's really what provoked the current conflict in Ukraine.
I think that's right, Brian. You look, you have to ask yourself, look how many countries around the world we have intervened with in for one reason or another that really have nothing to do with our security. Now, you compare that. Let's suppose there was an unconstitutional change of government in, say, Ottawa or Mexico City that would bring to power a very strongly anti-American government that wanted to ally that country with China or Russia. Do you think we might respond? Do you think we might do something to make sure we did not have a hostile government, a hostile ally of another country right on our border? Certainly, Russia would have perceived the unconstitutional change of power in Kiev, and there's no argument that it was constitutional, that, you know, you read the Constitution, Yanukovych was removed against the Ukrainian Constitution and against the votes of the people who elected him in 2010. And in some ways, by the way, when we hear about, you know, regime change operations, people say that's what's now coming back to the United States, too. When we look at the efforts of the deep state and the media to try to undo the results of last year's election here in this country. In any case, it seems to me that the Russians have a vital national security interest in Ukraine, unlike that phrase that we use all the time. We have a vital national security interest in Iraq or Iran or Syria, when, of course, we don't have any such interest in those countries.
Let's talk about the politics of the meeting between Trump and Poroshenko. Poroshenko was quoted about his visit, and this was a couple days earlier. He said, "It is very important that my meeting as the Ukrainian president in the White House will be earlier than Putin's meeting," meaning Putin's upcoming meeting with Trump. But what about the politics for Trump? I mean, Trump has been under siege. He's been labeled by the media, by the mainstream media, certainly by the Democratic establishment, without any incontrovertible proof, without really any proof yet, that he is an agent of Russia or colluding with Russia. And of course, Trump had promised or at least suggested a normalization of relations with Russia during the campaign. Was it important for Trump to meet with Poroshenko before meeting with Putin? In other words, to put his critics to the side, so to speak?
No, not really, because it won't do any good in that regard. He could go down that road all he wants. Nobody will say, well, gosh, this really proves that Trump is not a Russian puppet. I don't think it does him any good. Obviously, it does Poroshenko some good. And we say happening before a Putin summit. We don't know if there's going to be a Putin summit. There's been talk there could be a sidebar meeting in July at the G20, but there's nothing announced, nothing scheduled. And this should have been one of the very first summits the American president has upon his election with the leader of the Russian Federation, just as we, look, we had better relations with the Soviet Union when it was communist than we do now with non-communist Russia. This simply makes no sense from the point of American national interest or American security. And I think he has been sandbagged by the establishment here. There were reports that he early on, right after the inauguration, was moving forward with planning on a summit with President Putin of Russia, and it was stopped by the State Department. Daniel Freed was quoted in the media by saying he was getting calls, panic calls. My God, put a stop to this, and somehow they managed to do that.
But Trump will probably seek some benefit because now there's a cushion. He can always say to his critics, I met with Poroshenko first. In other words, he didn't have to meet with Poroshenko today. Matter of fact, it wasn't really scheduled. I mean,
sure,
we knew Poroshenko was going to meet with Mike Pence.
And I'm sure that is part of what they had in mind. And all I can say is I don't think it'll do much good for the braying hounds in the pack that's after him on this phony Russian story. And I think it is totally phony. Not only do I think the collusion story is phony, I think the hacking story is phony. I think it's all fake news. And again, you hear 17 intelligence agents, even Clapper says it's only three. And frankly, with their high confidence, you can park that right next to Saddam's WMDs. I don't take any of that seriously. It won't do him any good because it's all politically motivated. It's designed to block any kind of normalization with Moscow and also to undermine his authority here as the constitutionally elected president. Meeting with Poroshenko will not relieve that pressure.
Nord Stream 2, whereby Russia takes its ample, vast natural gas supply, brings it to Western Europe, brings it to an energy-starved part of the world, that western part of Eurasia called Western Europe. It can do it now with Nord Stream 2 through the Baltic. In other words, bypass Ukraine altogether. And the contracts Russia has with Ukraine expire, I believe, in 2018 or 2019 for the existing pipeline. They won't renew them under these circumstances. And so we're almost there. We're almost there with Nord Stream 2 as the vital supplier of natural gas to Europe. The only hope, it would seem to me, for those who want to stop it, is the imposition of sanctions. In other words, the United States doesn't pay a price about shutting Nord Stream down too, shutting it down, but the Europeans do. I mean, how does it play out now in politics? Of course, there's an upcoming German election. France just did vote. We had surprise results in the UK. In other words, everything's in flux in Europe. There's no equilibrium politically. How do you see it play out?
I'm not sure. And I guess one of the things that worries me here is that Angela Merkel has threatened retaliation of some sort. What is she going to do? As President Putin pointed out in a recent interview, Russia is one of the few countries in the world that has the luxury of being fully sovereign. Germany's not in that position, and the Germans know it. When she found out that Barack Obama was hacking her cell phone, what was her response? Just to meekly accept it. What could she do? Her intelligence services are controlled by Washington. Her military is controlled by Washington. We can threaten them with crippling financial measures if we want to. She is not in a position to counter threaten against us in retaliation for this. I don't know what they're going to do.
So under those circumstances, then perhaps the sanctions would work.
It's quite possible they will. Now, remember, the sanctions that were announced by Treasury today, I don't think they're not the big gun. I think the one we're looking at is S-722.
Yeah.
SS-722. We'll see what the House does. if they're at all doing their job, somebody from the White House needs to be talking to Paul Ryan and the House leadership and say, slow walk this thing. We need some decent waiver authority in this, which is standard in sanctions bills, which doesn't exist in the Senate passed bill. But to force the president's hand to say, we're going to impose these sanctions and really threaten our trading partners in order to spoil any possible rapprochement with Moscow simply makes no sense from the point of view of American national interest.
We have about a minute left, so I want to ask you a gigantic question about world affairs and where it's all going. Since the end of World War II, the U.S. has been the leader of the post-World War II world order so far as it pertains to Western Europe and in Asia as well, specifically Japan. That meant that Germany was cooperating with the United States. Germany was an occupied country by the United States, but it had access to global markets. Angela Merkel said just recently, under the current situation in Washington with Donald Trump as president, with the internal political civil war here in Washington, that Europe has to be prepared to go its own way. In other words, is the World War II, post-World War II world order sort of coming undone, fraying significantly in front of our very eyes?
It is, but I would say it's more of a crumble rather than an evolution. In other words, I don't see any will from the European Union, certainly not as an entity, with the kind of leadership they have now, starting with Mrs. Merkel. I mean, maybe if you got more national-minded leaders in various countries, like we saw through the Brexit vote, if the election had gone differently in France, we'd see some revival of an independent European spirit. But we're not seeing that now. These people are basically bureaucrats.
Okay, we are out of time. We've been talking with Jim Jatras. He is a political analyst and a former U.S. diplomat. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We said we were going to talk about the special election in Georgia, but we have breaking news. We're going to turn now to North Korea and U.S. DPRK relations. Of course, breaking news sometimes comes in a funny form. It comes in the form of a tweet. Donald Trump has tweeted about North Korea today, saying ominously that while he appreciates the efforts of China, quote, it has not worked out, close quote. The tweet comes just hours after he condemned the brutality of the North Korean regime. We are joined from Atlanta by Will Griffin. He is an organizer with the U.S.-based Stop Thaad in Korea and U.S. Militarism in Asia and the Pacific. You can learn more about them at stopthaad.org. Welcome, Will.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. Will Griffin, what do you make of Donald Trump's latest comments about the DPRK in China? He tweeted on Tuesday afternoon, while I greatly appreciate the efforts of President Xi and China to help with North Korea, it has not worked out. At least I know China tried. I mean, that sounds like we're at the end of a rope, the end of Donald Trump's rope. Might not be a very long rope.
I don't think so. It's kind of laughable to me personally, but at the same time, it's serious. I mean, he's really just blaming China for the faults of the U.S. as if it's China's. It's the fault of China why North Korea is developing nuclear weapons or existing on the Korean Peninsula. And I feel like that's just a quality that Trump has. I haven't read his book, The Art of the Deal, but I feel like this is a shining example of how Trump operates, where he'll just scapegoat anybody. And I think he's using this as a platform for his new policy towards the Korean Peninsula, known as the maximum pressure and engagement, where obviously – you know, he's going to be using more aggressive military posture, not only in Asia Pacific, but, you know, in the Middle East as well.
Okay, well, President Obama had strategic patience, which meant no engagement with the DPRK. During those last 8 years, while the U.S. was strategically patient, the DPRK significantly advanced its missile technology and its nuclear weapons program. Now the DPRK believes that nuclear weapons are indispensable to the country's security, and very few, only one country that was a nuclear power became a non-nuclear power, or maybe two if you consider some of the former Soviet republics, but that was South Africa following the fall of apartheid. But the reason we wanted to talk about this is it sounds so ominous, as if he tried to work with China. He said, China, it's your problem. You can solve the problem. But if you can't solve the problem, we will solve it. Now he's saying they can't solve it. They did try. Does that mean the U.S. is going to try something?
You know, well, there's definitely been some buildup in the Korean Peninsula. Korea, U.S., and even Canada have been planning for a military training exercise on the Korean Peninsula. USS Dewey just docked in Jeju Island at a Korean naval base. Maybe a week or two ago, the U.S. conducted a nuclear bomb-dropping drill.
I want the audience to really understand what you just said. A nuclear bomb dropping drill off of Korea. In other words,
the only way I can really get people to understand this is what if another country did a drill like that off the coast of California or Washington or New York or Florida? Like, how would the U.S. respond? Like, we know that this would lead to catastrophic results. And we're not playing around with just regular bombs. We're talking about nuclear drills, nuclear first strike drills.
The other thing about that, Will, is the leadership in the DPRK, and in fact, the entire population in North Korea knows that during the Korean War, which lasted between June 1950 and July 1953, the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff agreed unanimously to drop nuclear bombs on both the North Koreans and on China in an effort to get them to sign an armistice, which they finally did at the last minute in July 27, 1953. At the same time, the United States completely devastated North Korea through a mass aerial bombing. They used white phosphorus, they used napalm, they used all the weapons in the U.S. Air Force arsenal. And the main complaint of U.S. pilots by December 1950, 2 years before the war ended and 2 years before the bombing stopped, the main complaint of American pilots was, hey, there's nothing left to bomb because there wasn't one structure taller than one story still standing by December 1950. When you think of that, and then the U.S. has nuclear bomb dropping drills against this small country, I mean, and then we look at the news, if North Korea sends off an intermediate range missile test, the U.N. Security Council goes into emergency session. I mean, it's an amazing double standard.
Exactly. And guess what? It hasn't worked. North Korea is still there, and the U.S. is using it as an excuse to build up its military in the entire region. And, you know, going back to Trump's tweet, I think he just needs to replace the word China with U.S., that the U.S. posture in the region hasn't worked. We've been doing it for decades, having a huge military presence there and intensifying sanctions and continuing military training exercises and doing nuclear bomb dropping drills. Like, North Korea is not going to fold. And it's actually, we've pushed them into the corner where they have to develop nuclear weapons just to defend themselves. So Trump really needs to look into the mirror. The people of the U.S. need to look in the mirror and see what we are actually doing over there, because it's not going to be a war game. Like, Trump is really intensifying the tensions in that region. In North Korea, I mean, they are a small country.
You know, a Congressman, Tim Ryan, asked James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, last week. He said, why don't we just go to war against North Korea in order to stop their nuclear weapons program? That's what he said. Can't we just go to war? And Mattis then said, well, you know, we would win the war, but I have to tell you that Seoul, the capital of South Korea, 30 miles south of the DMZ, a city that has 25 million people, that's right, 25 million people in the metro area, that city would be wiped out. And of course, American troops would be largely wiped out too because of North Korea's vast conventional weapons system, including massive artillery. So Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, is actually telling these congresspeople, why can't we just have a war with North Korea, that it wouldn't be an easy war. In other words, whatever Trump thinks or whatever he tweets about, there are limitations to U.S. power in that part of the world.
Yeah, that's easy for them to say in their, you know, ivory tower where they won't be really engaged on the ground with the people. But, I mean, listen, the U.S. has done simulations and they know, the military experts should know. Not Mattis isn't a military expert. Let's get that clear. But the people who study this have done simulations, and they said, listen, within the first 24 hours of an attack, a million people would die in the first 24 hours. Who knows of how long a war like this would go on, not to mention that it would draw in other countries like China and Japan. And, you know, U.S., China, and Japan are the three top economies in the world. So this would definitely affect the entire global economy. So we would feel the ripples of this war, not to mention – you know, this military action is just too dangerous and too costly.
Then, Will Griffin, let's talk about what the U.S. will do. If they can't actually or not easily go to war, let's see what other options they have. Now, of course, the American tourist student Otto Warmbier died after returning from captivity. He was imprisoned in the DPRK. He was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment. He went at some point into a coma. The North Koreans brought him back just recently, and he's died. That's what prompted Trump to go on to the next Twitter storm. He said, the U.S. once again condemns the brutality of the North Korean regime as we mourn its latest victim. So let's talk about what the response will be from the Trump administration under these circumstances and what the tragic death, whatever the circumstances, and we don't really know what the circumstances were of Otto Warmbier's death, but obviously he died. The Daily Beast columnist Gordon Chang told CNBC the president is going to have to do something, and it's going to have to go well beyond condolences that he gave yesterday and a condemnation of North Korea. He needs to make clear to North Korea and other regimes that there will be a severe cost for harming an American. We mourn the loss of anyone who dies under these circumstances. But clearly, in other words, the point is American lives matter more, apparently, than a lot of other lives. But what is the more? What will be the something that Trump will do if war is not, in fact, an immediate option?
Well, he already wants to intensify sanctions, which clearly history has shown not to work. He seems to be upping military training exercises. Like I just mentioned, Canada is down there with U.S. and South Korea conducting naval exercises. And
what about a travel ban? What about right now Americans can go visit North Korea? What do you think? Do you think they'll do something like that, try to shut down travel between the U.S. and the DPRK?
Absolutely. That seems something. Trump has already done a Muslim ban, right? So banning travel to North Korea or anything to North Korea seems right up Trump's aisle. But we gotta fight this narrative that the Trump administration, even the U.S. and Pentagon, have been doing for decades. We got to challenge this whole demonization of North Korea. We have to challenge the U.S. military training exercises in the area. We have to stop trying to force North Korea to surrender because it's just not working. And my heart goes out to Otto and his family. It's very tragic, right? But, I mean, look at what the U.S. did on the war on terror with all the Arabs and Muslims, and we're still doing to this day. Like, but we have to face the real situation at hand is that the U.S. military and the U.S. government is not giving out the proper information to the American people and using examples like Otto's death, which, you know, we got to watch out for this next week, that Trump is going to use this as an excuse to create even more tensions on with North Korea and even with China, even through his tweet that he just tweeted today.
Yeah, last week, Rex Tillerson discussed the possibility of banning Americans from traveling to DPRK, saying, quote, we have been evaluating whether we should put some type of travel visa restriction to North Korea. We've not come to a final conclusion, but we are considering it. So, yeah, the State Department sounds like it's actively considering. Now the U.S. carried out a travel ban against the Cuban Revolution after the Bay of Pigs, when the U.S. had a failed proxy mercenary invasion in April 1961 to overthrow the Castro government. That failed, and afterwards the U.S. imposed a travel ban. It was illegal. People in the United States couldn't go to Cuba. And then an African-American journalist here in Washington, D.C. named William Worthy went to Cuba and defied the ban, and he was arrested and he was convicted, and his case went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled the U.S. government really can't stop Americans from traveling anywhere. So they imposed new restrictions, meaning you could now travel to Cuba you just couldn't spend a penny in Cuba, which made traveling to Cuba hard. Or you would have to get a license from the State Department or the Treasury Department. Right now, people can go to North Korea. What would stop the United States from carrying out a travel ban against the DPRK? I mean, is there something about travel to the DPRK that might be, in fact, beneficial to U.S. policy towards the DPRK?
I know I've known plenty of people, Korean Americans, South Koreans, and even, you know, white Americans who've been to North Korea and came back perfectly just fine. And is, you know, not a scary place to go. And but if this does happen, we have to fight this. And, you know, there's going to be plenty of people that's going to try to challenge that ban if it does happen.
But I want to ask you, Will, because this is all happening and it's in the news. You say it's not scary, which I've been to the DPRK. I've been there four times under different circumstances. I've traveled there extensively through all parts of the country. But why is it safe? In other words, certainly Otto's family wouldn't agree with your assessment. So what do you say to that argument?
Listen, the North Korea government really doesn't like the U.S. military and the U.S. government. As far as Americans go, they have no problem with it, and they make a clear distinction between the two. And most of the people who go there, you know, are just travelers. We want to go there. We want to make good relationships. We want to learn about the country, and we want to bring their stories back to wherever we came from. Yes, Otto is a scary story, and, you know, people probably will be fearful of that. But we have to keep in mind that there's been thousands and thousands that go there every single year and come back perfectly fine and have great stories. If there's one thing I can point people to is go on YouTube and type in The Haircut, which is a short 20-minute video of these two Australian white guys who travel to North Korea to literally just get a haircut. And they come back perfectly fine and they tell an amazing, funny story about their trip. And they point out a lot of the flaws that we always hear from the media and from the government and the military about how they demonize North Korea. And it just really isn't so.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I was in North Korea in 2013. I was there for the 60th anniversary of the Armistice Agreement. You know, the North Koreans want a peace treaty, just so our audience understands it. The U.S. technically is still at war with North Korea. That's why there's so much security. And the U.S. goes about the business of carrying out war games or war exercises that simulate the destruction of North Korea twice a year. The North Koreans, when they had this anniversary in July 2013, they said, we want a peace treaty. And of course, if the U.S. offered a peace treaty, the North Koreans would reciprocate. But when I was there, when I was in Pyongyang and I traveled to different parts of the country, I saw thousands of people who are not Korean. In other words, mainly European tourists, mainly young people, looking at the country, seeing for themselves what it's like. I think it's quite sad, in fact, that the American population only gets their news from the mainstream media, so it can take any terrible event, any incident like what happened with Otto, make a big caricature about it, and then generalize from it to complete the colorful demonizing picture of North Korea. So we only learn to, quote, hate North Koreans rather than try to understand North Korea, which I think is the most important thing. Go ahead. We have about a minute left.
Exactly. I completely agree. And we do have to understand North Korea's position. I mean, I can't stress this enough, the military posture that we have there. If you go to the U.S. Pacific Command's website, they state clearly that we have over 375,000 military and civilian personnel in the Asia Pacific region, right? 28,500 troops in South Korea alone. We have aircraft carriers in the region, 2,000 aircrafts in the region. So all this military posture that's aimed right at North Korea and on its borders. And we have to realize, listen, we could try to freeze North Korea's nuclear program, but we would have to, in exchange, stop our nuclear first strike policy where we're constantly threatening them every single day. We have to end the military war games that's on its doorstep, and we have to resolve this conflict with a peace treaty, which, by the way, it will be between the U.S. and North Korea and not South Korea and North Korea. And as long as people get some of this information in and can think critically, I think people will come to a different conclusion about their views on North Korea as a whole.
I agree with you. In Washington, D.C., we're going to be visited by the new South Korean president, Moon Jae-in. He's a progressive, a more liberal president. He said before he wants normalization or the beginning of normalizations of relations with North Korea, which, of course, is the precondition. But without Washington signing on, there will be no denuclearization or thaw or normalization between North and South Korea, because Washington is the big player. Anyway, Will Griffin, thanks so much. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.